Morning, everybody.
Morning.
Hello, Howard.
Hi, Jean. We got about 4 minutes here till we get started.
Good morning, it's Ann Barnes.
Hi, Ann.
Hey, Howard.
How you doing?
Good, how you doing?
Good, thank you. Trying to withstand the heat.
Yeah, it's going to be a hot one today until the storms this afternoon take care of it.
Yep. Of course, we were all complaining about the cold in February, right?
Yes, we were.
Hey, Howard, it's Elton.
Hey, how are you?
Hi. Fine, how you doing?
Doing swimmingly, thank you. Get about 2 minutes, guys, and we will be off. Mm-hmm. Grab that last cup of coffee. Okay, we're going to be off and running. My official clock says 9:02, so that's good for me. Good morning, everybody, and I hope everybody's enjoying the summer. Hard to believe July is almost here, but it is. And that means that this is the last telebrief in the month of June. And then, of course, we will have the next telebrief on July the 9th, which is the second Wednesday in July, and then July 23rd. Okay, there is a fair amount to report on sort of the legislative side of the table. So let me get started. The Labor Department, the Department of Labor, last Friday issued a proposed rule. I don't know if any of you saw it, but I wanted to bring it to your attention. And in this rule, it's proposed that an employee be eligible for leave to care for a same-sex spouse under the Family and Medical Leave Act, regardless of whether that employee lives in a state that recognizes same-sex marriage. So that, as the Secretary of Labor, Thomas Perez, says, and I quote him, the basic promise of the FMLA is that no one should have to choose between succeeding at work and being a loving family caregiver. Under the proposed revisions, the FMLA will be applied to all families equally, enabling individuals in same-sex marriages to fully exercise their rights and fulfill their responsibilities to their families. Obviously, from the standpoint of where you are practically, this is not a final rule yet. This is a proposed rule, but it certainly gives you an idea of the direction that the Department of Labor will be taking, and probably gives us a good idea of how it may wind up in terms of the trends for implementation of the Family and Medical Leave Act. Now, some of you may voluntarily amend your policies, your Family and Medical Leave Act policies, to include same-sex partners or people in same-sex marriages. You're not obligated to do that yet. As in any situation involving a proposed rule, there's a comment period under which employers as well as employee groups can comment. And then, of course, it would have to be enacted as a final rule. But this is a good indication, I think, of where it certainly may wind up. And without a kind of any editorial comment on whether, you know, same-sex marriage is legitimate or illegitimate, it seems to me that you're going to need to pay attention to this, because if it's enacted as a final rule, then everyone would have to change their Family and Medical Leave Act policies, which are written in their handbooks or standalone policies. So I will keep you apprised of this. It just happened last Friday, and I'm sure there will be significant comments, particularly by the Chamber of Commerce and probably the National Association of Manufacturers. There was another significant, what I would call legislative proposal, which was introduced on June the 18th, which was last Wednesday. So on that date, Senator Tom Harkin, who's chairman of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, along with eight other Democrats, introduced a bill which has its purpose of restoring overtime protections to a good number of low and mid-wage salaried workers. In this bill, essentially what the main proposal is that I see it, and by the way, the senators that sponsored this bill were Senators Brown of Ohio, Boxer of California, Casey of Pennsylvania, Leahy of Vermont, Markey of Massachusetts, Murray of Washington State, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. The key in this particular bill would be raising the overtime salary level for the white-collar exemptions from $455 a week to $1,090 a week. Essentially, according to the senators, which would match the inflation-adjusted level from 1975, and this new threshold level would be phased in over a period of time, and then it would be increased according to the inflationary levels after that period of time. Now, just to review with you, because I've spoken about white-collar exemptions before, as you know, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, in order to be classified as an exempt employee, either administrative, professional, or executive, you not only have to meet a duties and responsibilities test, but you also have to meet a salary test. You have to be paid on a salary basis, on a, you know, and it has to be a predetermined amount, and it has to be at least $455 a week, which of course equates to roughly $24,000 a year, which is probably a ridiculously low amount of money to be considered an exempt employee. So the proposal that's in this particular piece of legislation is to increase that salary level from $455 to $1,090, which equates to, on an annualized basis, about $57,000 a year, probably more in keeping with the nomenclature that we would use to describe somebody who is a white-collar exempt employee. Now, the practical import of that, however, would be that there are many people who may not make that $55,000 or $56,000 a year based on a salary basis. And so if this particular piece of legislation were to be enacted, you'd have a number of people who would no longer be able to be classified as exempt managers or administrative people or professional employees. And therefore, unless their salaries were dramatically increased, they would then be non-exempt and be eligible for overtime, which is one of the goals of this piece of legislation. Another aspect of the legislation or proposed legislation is to go back to the old definition of primary duty and essentially say that if a worker does not perform at least 50% of his work in an exempt category, that that person cannot be deemed to be an exempt employee. It used to be the law prior to 2004. And then in 2004, the white-collar exemption regulations were changed so that there was no longer sort of a 50% threshold or touchstone. This proposed legislation would amend that and, again, require that the so-called exempt employee must spend at least 50% of his time in the exempt category of duties. And finally, the proposed bill would create penalties for violations of the record-keeping provisions of the FLSA, and they would be up to $1,100 if the violation is deemed to be willful or repeated. Again, as I've stated to you before with regard to the proposed FMLA modification, this is proposed legislation. It's not enacted yet. And given the fact that, you know, you have a significant number of Republicans who probably would oppose this, I'm not telling you that it has a good chance of being enacted, but there are certainly some influential senators who have sponsored this particular piece of legislation. And again, this has to do with the desire to make more and more people eligible for overtime pay, because it would involve their reclassification from exempt employees to non-exempt employees. And as I've stated to you repeatedly in these telebriefs, it certainly behooves you to go back and to take a look at your job descriptions and to take a look at the actual duties and responsibilities of your job classifications, and make sure that people or individuals that you've classified as exempt truly are exempt, both under a duties test and under, of course, the low salaries test that we have right now. So stay tuned. I'll follow this legislation, and if it has a big chance of being enacted, I'll, of course, let you all know. Now, thirdly, the Secretary of Labor on June the 13th announced a proposed rule that would raise the minimum wage for workers on federal service and construction contracts to $10.10 per hour. This implements the executive order, which was issued by President Obama on February the 12th. Essentially, under the DOL's analysis, they believe that this would involve about 200,000 workers who would see this increase, and it would be effective on all solicitations issued after January 1st, 2015, and to contracts that are awarded outside the solicitation process on or after January 1st, 2015. Those of you who are federal contractors out there will need to pay attention to this. So if any of you do work under the Service Contract Act, this would certainly apply to you. All of this, and I've said this before, all of this has the purpose, really, of getting through the back door what the president has been unable to get through the front door, i.e., legislation which would increase the minimum wage from $7.25, the current $7.25, to $10.10. And that's certainly on the president's agenda, but has been unable to be passed as legislation for everyone. But this is legislation, or at least proposed rules under the Department of Labor, for those people who would be federal contractors. Again, this is a proposed rule by the DOL. There's a comment period by employer associations, and I'm sure that there will be significant comments by the National Association of Manufacturers and the Chamber of Commerce. Finally, sort of on this legislative agenda, President Obama, according to many sources, plans to sign an executive order which would prohibit federal contractors from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. So while this has not been ordered yet in terms of a formal executive order, all the signs point that way. Again, another indication that we have a very activist president and Department of Labor in attempting to enact by executive order and or Department of Labor rule pieces of legislation which have not been successful through Congress. So stay tuned on that. Now, let me turn my attention to some developments at the National Labor Relations Board, only because they certainly impact many of you, even if you are non-union employers. So last week, on June 18th, a group of business associations, including the Chamber of Commerce and Construction Trades, filed a brief with the National Labor Relations Board. And the purpose of the brief filed by these employer groups was to persuade the National Labor Relations Board not to retrench on its 2007 ruling in a case called Register Guard, which indicated that employers do not have to give employees access to their email systems in order to use them for purposes protected under Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act. Again, as we've talked about before, the National Labor Relations Act, specifically Section 7 of the Act, gives employees, whether they're unionized or non-unionized, the right to engage in what's called concerted protected activity for the purposes of discussing wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment. Ford has given every indication that it may seek to reverse, even by rule, the 2007 Register Guard ruling. And in their brief to the National Labor Relations Board, these employer groups wrote, and I'll quote, "The board has until now consistently upheld the property right of employers with regard to every mode of employer communication that has come before the agency over many decades, including employer-owned telephones, bulletin boards, televisions, copy machines, and of course, email systems. There is no justifiable basis," wrote these employer groups, "for creating a new right of employees to compel their employers to allow use of company email systems for Section 7 purposes." The unions, of course, have urged the National Labor Relations Board to overrule Register Guard and issue a rule that would allow employees to use their employer's email systems for work purposes, conditioned only on the so-called employer's right to maintain production and discipline, which of course would be found to be non-existent probably by the current National Labor Relations Board. The rule has not been issued yet, but again, there's every indication that it may be in the near future. And the reason that it has practical import for those of you who are non-union at the present time is because in a union organization campaign traditionally, there are only a couple ways in which a union can generally reach out to employees and only so many ways that the employees can reach out to each other. So employees typically do not have the right to solicit each other for purposes of discussing union issues or union organization issues on work time or in work areas, or to distribute literature on work time and work areas. If this Register Guard rule were to be overturned, what you would find, I believe, is a plethora of situations where employees would be using their employer's email systems, whether it was work time or not, to be soliciting their co-employees. And I think it would be very dangerous for employers because email is so easy to use, so accessible to use, and so difficult to monitor by an employer. So this is, again, an extension, I believe, of the National Labor Relations Board going out of its way to have an impact on non-union employers in a fairly damaging way. And I will keep track of where this thing has gone, but it has all the earmarks of coming into play. Now, just because the board would issue a rule that may overrule Register Guard doesn't mean that it wouldn't be challenged in court. And I have a good feeling that if it were challenged in court by one of the employer groups, that the court probably would slap the board's hands and say, this is not going to be enforced. Nevertheless, it is another indication of the National Labor Relations Board being extremely activist when it comes to non-union employees. And I will point out a decision which was just issued on May the 28th by the National Labor Relations Board, which is another indication of, in my opinion, of it being extremely impractical and unworldly when it comes to making decisions and looking at employer actions, particularly employer actions in a non-union setting. So in a case called Plaza Auto Center and a charging party named Nick Aguirre, what happened was, in this case, the employer, Plaza Auto Center, sold cars in Arizona. And it hired this guy, Nick Aguirre, as a salesman at the end of at the end of August 2008, and fired him on October 28, 2008. Supposedly, this guy, Aguirre, had talked to his fellow employees and managers about the employer's policies concerning breaks and restroom facilities and compensation. Anyway, he was called into a meeting with some management officials where they wanted to talk to him about his negativity on the job, his lack of attention to the job, etc. And to make a long story the employer representatives told this guy that they didn't trust him. And during this conversation, this guy, Aguirre, lost his temper. And according to the board, this is the board's decision, and in a raised voice started berating one of the management representatives, calling him and I'm sure this is not something that none of you have heard before. This is in the board's decision. Called the management representative a fucking motherfucking and a fucking crook and an asshole. The employee went on to tell the manager that he was stupid, nobody liked him, and everyone talked about him behind his back. During the outburst, Aguirre, that's the employee, stood up in the small office, pushed his chair aside, and told the manager that if the company or he fired him, that the manager would regret it. And after that, no surprise, the manager fired this guy. So he files an unfair labor practice charge, contending that he was fired for having engaged in protected activity. Now remember, under the National Labor Relations Act, just because you may have engaged in protected activity doesn't immunize you from being terminated if the nature of your activity is so egregious that it would take it out of really the category of protected activity. And the board stated in its decision, they say, applying the applicable standard, we conclude based on all the evidence that Aguirre's conduct was not menacing, physically aggressive, or belligerent. In the first place, we find that Aguirre's statement that if he were fired, Plaza would regret it was not a threat of physical harm in the circumstances of this case. It is beyond peradventure that Aguirre's regretted statement did not explicitly refer to physical harm in any way. Rather, that statement was ambiguous on its face. They want to find that essentially that it is possible for an employee to have an outburst way against him, yet still retain the act's protection because the other factors weigh heavily in his favor. And they went on to find that, therefore, the termination of this character was legitimate, that the termination was illegitimate, and that he should be reinstated with full back pay. The dissenting opinion in this case, and I'll just read some very succinct provisions of his opinion, says, and this is by the Republican member, "Today my colleagues find a clearly justified employee discharge to be unlawful." He goes on to say, "Their approach implies that such misbehavior is normative, or at least that the act maintains tolerance of it whenever profane and menacing outbursts are somehow connected to protected concerted activity. I disagree. By this standard, employees like Nick Aguirre will be permitted to curse, denigrate, and defy their managers with impunity during the course of otherwise protected activity, provided they do so in front of a relatively small audience, can point to some provocation, and do not make overt physical threats. In my view, few, if any, employers would countenance such behavior in the absence of protected activity. I do not believe they must act so differently when the confrontation involves protected activity. Indeed, the abnegation of the respondent, that's the employer's right, to discharge Aguirre in the circumstances of this case run counter to the overarching policies of promoting industrial peace and labor relations stability under our act and impedes effective enforcement of other employment laws. A very strong statement in a dissenting opinion. And I cite this case, just decided a few weeks ago. Again, following up on what I've told you about, for instance, the board's attempt to change the rules with regard to employee access to emails. It shows, in my opinion, a gross either ignorance of or apathy or disregard of the real world of industrial relations. And to say that an employee can engage with impunity in this kind of insubordinate and almost violent conduct toward its employer or managers and hide under the cloak of protected activity is absurd. And I caution you that you may have employees who are very streetwise and who may use the banner of being engaged in protected activity. That is, they may say, well, I am acting on behalf of other employees, or I want to talk to you about the terms and conditions of employment, or the wages, or the benefits, and in the context of that purported protected activity, nevertheless engage in what we all probably would call disrespectful, almost violent, or insubordinate conduct, and yet still, under the current board's analysis, be protected. I don't believe that this is the attitude that would be upheld in the appellate courts. But still, if you're an employer, it takes a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of administrative burden to get to the Court of Appeal. So if you're in a situation where you're involved with a potential termination of an employee and there's the whiff of protected activity where that employee has purportedly spoken on or acted on behalf of other employees, be careful or talk to your labor attorney about whether you can go ahead with some degree of assurance that that activity of firing the person will not be overturned at the National Labor Relations Board and that you won't have a situation where the employee is reinstated with full back pay. Again, a very disconcerting decision, in my view, otherworldly and violative of most of what we as professionals in the field would say was a well-merited termination under the circumstances. Okay, as always, I invite any questions or comments from those of you who are out there participating in the call. If you don't want to do it that way, and I've had this many times, you may want to submit an email to me at hkerman@offutkerman.com or my direct number, 410-209-6417. As I've stated before, we will be putting on a half-day sort of labor employment summit in the fall, date to be handed out as we go through the summer. And again, the next telebrief will be on July the 9th. Any questions or comments?
Nope.
Okay. Well, that means that all of you are now completely confused by what I've said or weren't listening or don't care. But in any event,
Howard, this is Ann. Just let me make the point that on the if Register Guard is overturned, it will empower unions also that some of us already have. It will strengthen them. It will give them tremendous ability to communicate that now they have to struggle with.
I totally agree.
It will make organizing. It will make mischief. It will make all the terms and conditions. That will be a terrible, terrible ruling. But I don't know that it would survive in the courts, but it would cause wreak havoc for all of us, union and non-union alike.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say, of course, is that until that decision is overturned, you all need to make sure that your policies and procedures indicate that employees have no right to use email for private purposes. So just a word to the wise. And Ann, thanks for your input. Appreciate it. Okay, everybody, thanks for participating, and we'll see you, at least figuratively, on July the 9th. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Howard.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.